The following is a Bachelor of Arts production.
Previously on the Supporting Act podcast.
It's the suitcase guy.
This week on a very special Supporting Act podcast.
A lot of my peers in the folk scene now were people that were doing punk rock music, you know, when we were all growing up.
You're listening to episode number 41 of the Supporting Act podcast, in which I sit down with Danielle Pelokan-Hoffner of Red Moon Road. Stay tuned, you might learn something. Welcome to episode number 41 of the Supporting Act podcast. My name is Matt Moskal. I'll be your host. I'm a musician by trade, a journalist by education, and a spin-off of Happy Days. If you're unfamiliar with the show, this is the program where we illuminate the careers of comedians, musicians, and artists just shy of the mainstream spotlight. It is an independently produced podcast that is brought to you free of charge every Wednesday on Liberated Syndication, Stitcher Radio, as well as showbizmonkeys.com, Tumblr, and you can follow us on Twitter at TSAPod. That is Red Moon Road in the background, a Winnipeg-based group that is fast on their way to becoming Canada's favorite campfire band. Joining me in the Llama House this week is Danielle Pelokan-Hoffner. He makes up one-third of Red Moon Road, along with Sheena Ratai and Daniel Jordan. The trio are a modern vessel for the traditions of folk music and the stories of old, so it's only appropriate that they spent their summer traveling around Ontario playing various folk festivals. In the process, they recorded a brand new record and will be beginning a grassroots campaign to help fund the costs of that.
I got a woman, she treats me mean. Out in public where we get seen. And everybody's saying I should leave her alone. They don't see it when she takes me home.
Now, Danielle himself is no stranger to the world of music. He started off in a number of punk and hardcore bands. He even played in a progressive metal group with his brothers. He has a proud family tradition of music performance. And it was a pleasure to chat with him about that that transformation, going from something with a really hard edge to something that some might consider a little on the softer side. A process he refers to as maturing, really. In this conversation, we get to talking about folk traditions, playing folk festivals, workshopping, as well as recording the band's new album and crowdsourcing it. We also got to talking about how David Suzuki got him turned on to electric guitar, or, you know, his career-long ambition to perform on the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean. So it is with great pleasure that I present to you my conversation with Danielle Pelokan-Hoffner of the band Red Moon Road. Working on a crowdfunding campaign. That's the, like, that's sort of where you were before you came here.
Minutes before this interview.
Minutes.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. The rest of my band and a couple of friends were putting together the introductory video for a crowdfunding campaign. We decided to work with Pledge Music.
All right.
They're based out of Boston, and there are a number of different platforms available on the market right now, but that seems to be the one that was most in tune with our philosophy of the way that we were looking to source from our fans. And so yeah, the first step is always getting that introductory video, making sure that you're placing your personality and your reasons first and foremost. So that's Yeah, that's done now. And it's now in the editing process. In the next couple of weeks, we'll be launching the campaign with all sorts of fun exclusives, like access to, well, you know, just, it's like, it's a crowdfunder, just like any other crowdfunder.
It's like you have to go through everything you can do for other people, everything that you have, and find a way to please them while still pleasing yourself at the same time, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of strange, like monetizing all the fun things that you like to do. You know, it's a bizarre sort of almost corporate kind of trick, but at the same time, it feels good because it's something that, that is directly to your fans.
You it's know? Grassroots.
Yeah, it quite literally grassroots.
Well, there's like bands like Chicks Dig It, who are a Canadian punk band, that they had t-shirts before they even played their first show, just as a way to sort of raise money to, you know, buy new instruments and
to get a recording together, because that costs money too.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, they immediately went out there and said, this is a worthwhile investment to put something interesting that we have fun doing and then basically just kind of offer to people. Like, it's an exchange. It's a good for service exchange, but it's also, it feels good on both ends.
Yeah. Both for the person who's supplying the product and for the people who are purchasing, or I don't know. There's all sorts of weird industry buzzwords that you should and shouldn't use, but yeah, it's a mutually beneficial experience.
I'm kind of like Nicolas Cage around buzzwords. I'm just kind of like, not the bees, not the bees.
Stay away.
Yeah, exactly. So this crowdfunding is going towards a new record or a new project?
Yeah, it's essentially the newest album. The first time that we've actually collaborated, the three of us, to do recording. It's the recording is already done. All the sound has been taken. It was done at Private Ear Studios here in Winnipeg.
Okay.
But we flew in David Travers Smith, who's based out of Toronto, to do the engineering and some of the production. So we essentially recorded it in about 16 or so days here in Winnipeg, and then we flew him back to Toronto at the end of May when the session was done. And then over the course of the summer, we've been touring basically in Ontario, and as well as PEI and Nova Scotia, doing the festival circuit out there. So during the weekdays when we had fewer gigs, we were spending time in his studio in Toronto, finishing up the mixes and doing the last little bits of overdubbing. So now the product is almost finished, and as it stands, we're waiting back on mixes right now, so we're sort of on the edge of our seat to see like what it's all finally going to sound like. And so we're sort of turning our eyes towards the future a little bit and seeing how it is that we're going to be able to release it. We've got an award-winning designer, Michael Wycraft, who's on the line to do the design and the album artwork, so we're going to be commissioning two brand new pieces from him.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting, and especially that he agreed to do it. I guess him and David are good friends, and we've gotten to know the two of them over the course of the last 3 years as we've been, you know, slowly working our way up the folk music ladder,
yeah,
as it were. So the funds are basically going to go towards finishing the recording itself, like the manufacturing and the mastering, and publicity, because it's one thing to have a final record that you're really proud of, but if it doesn't really get out to the world, then there's no sense in doing it in the first place. So it's that sort of final step at the top of the stairs that most people don't see from the ground level.
No, exactly. That's the best way of putting it too. I was about to say people don't consider post-production, or don't consider what happens after something is made. I guess the film industry is a different story because there's so much post-production these days because
Definitely.
Of animation and design.
Exactly.
But like in the music industry, post-production is still a huge part of it, whether it be marketing, whether it be packaging, whether it be even mixing and mastering.
Yeah, balancing sounds, man, is a really important thing. But also balancing how you look in the public's eye as well. A lot of it is marketing and imaging, and making sure that your, you know, your web face and like all your Facebooks and Twitters and Instagrams and whatnots all look the same as your website, and that all looks the same as your you know, your brand for the album itself. So we're sort of in that process right now of fine tuning everything to make sure that once it finally does hit the ground, that all the newspapers and radio stations that'll be picking it up will hopefully see like that we've got our act together, you know, and are really ready for to hit the ground running with this thing.
And how much of this is you, and how much of this is an organization that's behind you?
Well, the organization is us, so really I'm 33% of it, and the other 66% of the other two bandmates. At this point, it's really very much a trio, and we just incorporated it also. So there's all these weird, like, bizarre business parts of it that we're sort of getting to know as we make our way along this bizarre career path that we've chosen. But that said, we're coming to the point where we just can't handle it ourselves anymore, in the sense that we're getting, we're going to be playing the States for the first time at the end of, at the end of the month. We'll be touring from Vancouver down to LA over the course of the month of October before we release our album in November. So that, we end up outsourcing some of the booking for that. A friend of ours, actually based here in Winnipeg, he's, got a production company called Morning Noise Productions. Eric Lemoine is his name. You might know him from the F-Holes.
Okay.
And he also is in Miss Higgins and the Winnipeg Five. That's sort of one of his brainchildren. So we got him to do some of the booking for us for the first time, and we're using another agent in the eastern part of the States. So we're slowly outsourcing, feeling out to see like who's actually going to be a part of the long-term team, because we're coming to realize now that we're so invested in this that we've got basically nothing else. We're all in. We're so all in that we're looking for other people to be all in also at the same time. So fortunately, there's a great deal of very trustworthy and hardworking people out there that are slugging away in the same industry for pennies and mostly for love. And we're hoping that if we can build this vehicle together, it'll be a perpetual motion machine with all the right parts.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics, though.
Oh, well, the second I step outside here, laws 1 through 3 are completely out the window.
Exactly, exactly. Speaking of climbing the folk music ladder, I find your transformation, your evolution as a musician, very interesting. I have written down here, started in progressive metal and now aiming for the Vinyl Cafe.
True story.
Yeah, so you started off in sort of a different sound in your music. Do you remember what the first instrument you picked up was, or what the first instrument you started playing was?
Yeah, sure. I can give you a bit of an overview, as it were. So the timeline began when I was 3 years old. My parents decided, as you know, good, strong-willed parents will often do, they want their children to grow up with all the possible benefits of, you know, options in terms of their learning and development. And so they put me into music lessons when I was 3 years old.
Okay.
And it started with piano, I guess, was the fundamental instrument. And I had a really great music teacher who was not only fun and engaging, but inspiring as well. So that really kind of kicked things off. So I did the classical program, the Royal Conservatory program for piano. My father was a musician as well, still is a great player, and he played folk music. So he had a few guitars kicking around the house. Inevitably ended up picking that up for a little while. Ended up playing drums as well for a long time. I think, you know what? It was on a David Suzuki tape.
Okay.
Like David Suzuki put out these little educational songs in tape format that my mom had picked up somewhere along the way. And I heard like an amplified guitar lick the first time on that. And it just blew my mind. I just like rewinded it and played it. And just gave me a feeling inside like nothing else that I've ever experience. So I guess I sort of took a turn towards the distorted at that point.
David Suzuki introduced you to the distorted guitar sound.
Weird, right? I wish, and you know, I was just at the farm yesterday. I should have tracked that tape down at some point in the next year. I got to track it down and just like hear it and almost maybe sample it, you know, at some point and see if I can bring that back into my musical life these days. But yeah, I guess aggressive music really kind of caught my ear when there's a great hardcore scene that sort of popped up in Dauphin, Manitoba, which is the next town over from where I grew up in St. Rose. And, I went to go see live shows, punk rock shows that were happening there. And I really loved the community. And also, all that European metal, like that really, that black metal stuff that's coming out of Finland and Norway is really based in classical form.
Yeah.
So I found that there was a lot of parallels into what I was learning in classical music paired with the aggression that I was feeling as every young teenager feels.
I never looked at metal that way before. That's an interesting way of disassembling the whole idea. It's like something that is very, it's obviously you kind of have to be a bit of a virtuoso to match wits with the players in Europe these days, especially, you know, what's coming out, like teenagers learning how to play like Through the Fire and Flames by Dragon Force on like Guitar Hero and then being like, well, now I want to play that in real life. Like that's a natural progression people are going through nowadays.
Taking it up the next step. Exactly. And metal's just been like out meddling, you know, band after band is just trying to make it more brutal or more death.
Yeah.
Or whatever. So they're just continually pushing the boundaries. It's pretty inspiring to see the ways that they're taking it. And it's, some of it's really creative and beautiful. Some of it's just absolute garbage. But
yeah,
that's all right. It's for every listener to sort out for themselves.
Yeah. I just love, one of my favorite things to do is to put a metal record on between, like, I'll listen to like a sweet, like, folk record and then like a hip hop album, and then just throw on something brutal. And for whatever reason, like, that's the one that I'll remember the most, is the, you know, the one that made my ears kind of perk up a little more and the hair on the back of my neck stand up was something that completely, almost like challenged my masculinity by listening to it.
Yeah, exactly.
But in terms of, so you're going to punk, sorry, hardcore shows, like, Louder Music playing in Dauphin, Manitoba. It's strange how, like, I'm thinking about this now because I grew up in a small town and you never really...
Ingersoll, right?
Ingersoll, Ontario. Yeah.
You just played a festival there this summer.
Exactly. Yeah, you did Sudbury to Ingersoll, which is like the opposite of my progression. So you went Winnipeg to Sudbury to Ingersoll, which is like backwards version of my travels. I went Ingersoll, Sudbury, and then Winnipeg.
Yeah, so. Same path, different times.
Exactly. Yeah. How did you like playing in Ingersoll? I didn't even know they had a folk community because all I could go to as a kid was hardcore shows.
Right. Interesting how, like, folk music is really reserved almost for an older crowd and a listening audience, which is not something that the industry tends to credit younger listeners with.
Yeah.
But with the advent of folk festivals and camping at these folk festivals, the experience of camping and that sort of community, they're drawing a much younger and younger crowd. But Ingersoll was great, man. It's a super cool community, and the mayor was the artistic director.
Yeah.
And it was free to the public, which meant that anyone off the street could just walk in and check it out. They obviously had corporate sponsorship and sponsorship from both the federal and the provincial levels. And, the city itself must have kicked in as well. But they paid the musicians great from my perspective. And the audience loved it. They were there from the very beginning of sound checks to the very bitter end of the evening.
Really?
Yeah, it was really great. They had great acts like, Valdi was there. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
He's he did Northern Lights Festival a couple of times when I was living in Sudbury.
Yeah, he's a hero, you know, like the man's an absolute legend. So they had him, which is, laurels enough in their caps. They also had, what was his name? Graham Wardrop. He's a fingerstyle guitar player from New Zealand who's just an absolute boss. Yeah, all sorts of great acts, but great local acts also. There's a nice balance between featuring local acts as well as world-class performances and putting them on stages side by side just to show that, you know, what you have in your backyard is just as good as what there is on the world stage.
And I think that's one of the biggest, most important parts of any folk festival, really, is to have that balance in the lineup. And, you know, from the corporate standpoint, as we've been talking about corporate interest in music or incorporating yourself.
I know it's gross, but it's inevitable.
It's inevitable. It's inevitable because everyone has to make a living, right?
That's just it.
Yeah. So when you look at it from like a corporate standpoint, it's like, yeah, let's book some local people because they're not going to have an insane rider or travel costs, or we're not going to need to give them a place to stay, and we're not going to need to pay them too much to perform because, like, for example, I did Northern Lights Festival Boreal with Broken Social Scene and the Weaker Vans.
Nice.
I can always say I played at a music festival with Broken Social Scene and the Weaker Vans, and people will be, you know, asking questions about it. So
totally.
Yeah. So that looks good on my behalf. And then on their behalf, it's like, we don't have to pay you too much. It might seem like it's almost like they're undermining the importance of booking local people, but it's actually quite the opposite. It's something that works very well all around. It's a very balanced decision.
Yeah, it's a mutually beneficial choice, especially in the sense that local artists are more local artists will draw in a way that big names might not. If you don't already know who's big in the folk scene, you might not be drawn to that festival because of them. But if there's someone local in the area who's involved in the community, is going to be playing there as well, we'll be inviting a whole other demographic of people that might not be showing up in the first place. So in that sense, it benefits the festival in terms of ticket sales as well, if you're selling tickets, which Canterbury was not. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, at Canterbury Folk Festival, I mean, I imagine like a lot of people coming out are would be family or close friends of the people who are performing, the locals that are going out and taking part in the festival. Because mm-hmm. a big thing about folk music is the fact that it is something that sort of transcends generations. I mean, you can, mm-hmm. I mean, there's that feeling you get the first time you find like an old like Appalachian like folk song that was like sung around the mountains and you hear it and it's like, oh, this is gorgeous. And then it's like, yeah, that's just one of like a thousand interpretations of that song.
That's just it. Like it wasn't even recorded. Until you know, like late in the 1800s, those songs have been already been around for, you know, 50 to 100 years, and they've just been played in people's backyards. It wasn't for performances; that was just for it's just folk music
for kicks.
Yeah, exactly. It's just to pass the time. The sort of thing you do around a campfire, and it's passed on from the bouche à oreille, from mouth to ear. There's a, how do you say that?
From
word of mouth, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Okay. But it's passed on from person, from performer to listener, and then someone takes that song, carries it to another town, and then it just metamorphosizes, I guess. Evolves, I suppose, would be a more accurate term, as it encounters all these different mutations.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's at a folk festival, and then thousands of people hear it and might take that back to their own communities and play it again. Yeah, it's a really beautiful and really organic thing. It definitely does transcend generations, as you said. Songs like that transcend not only space and time, but experience as well. Like the deep experiential feeling that you get when you hear a tune that haunts you. You can hear that as a child, like if it's David Suzuki, you know?
Yeah.
Or you can hear it as someone on their deathbed. It might have that exact same feeling. That's that transcends.
It's interesting you started off with piano and made the progression from there. I tend to find, just from listening to interviews with musicians a lot, like a lot of people who start with piano wind up playing a handful of instruments and becoming multi-instrumentalists. Mm-hmm. There's a really great quote in one of your band's bios that everyone plays miscellaneous instruments that intrigue them, mm-hmm. which I think is a unique way of saying we're playing whatever tonight. We're just gonna go up there and, you know, he's gonna play keys, then he's gonna switch to this, and then you see bands like the Arcade Fire where like Richard Reed Perry is playing like eight instruments, you
right.
can't pin him down to one.
Yeah.
That's something I find that's tied a lot to piano players. Is it because the piano is one of the most, straightforward ways to deliver melody or rhythm or?
The thing is, it can deliver melody and rhythm at the same time. It's an interesting bridge between a percussion instrument and a string instrument, because it's actually hammers that are striking a string to actuate the vibration. So there's a percussive element in that sense, but it's also melodic because the well-tempered clavier divides the scale into 12 different degrees, and then those degrees can be divided into keys as well. So essentially, it's also very visual. It's laid out in front of you, in 88 keys. Essentially, all of the notes that you could possibly play, and you have 10 fingers, so you can play 10 different notes at any given time. So really, it allows you to play a single note to two notes, and all the varying degrees in between. So I can only speak from my own experience in terms of the jump to multiple instruments, but because I learned the basic theory on a piano, I felt like I had such an intimate grasp of what music actually was that it was easy for it to transcend onto a different instrument. It was essentially getting the same sounds and melodies and rhythms that I would get from a piano when I moved to guitar. It was just, I literally sat there with a guitar on my lap and then a piano in front of me, so I'd play a C and then try and find a C on the fretboard, you know. And then eventually, as I built up the repertoire of my left hand technique on a string instrument of how to fret those strings, it was just a matter of strumming with the right hand.
Yeah.
So you can build chords based off of one note just as you can with the piano, but you're just limited to four. Six, technically, strings that you can play at any given time. But at the same time, there are like five different ways to play the same chord on a guitar's fretboard. It's pretty amazing. And all stringed instruments are just variations on the same theme, really. Like a mandolin is tuned in fifths instead of fourths. And so the way that you run up and down a scale might be a little bit different, but the technique is really the same. Like you're still picking or strumming with your right hand. and you're fretting with your left hand. So all stringed instruments after that are really just variations on a theme.
Yeah. I kind of look at ukuleles like Rubik's Cubes for guitar players. Like, you see so many guitar players playing ukuleles these days. I think that's just because, you know, someone saw one in a movie or just became popular. I wish it became popular when the movie The Jerk came out and Steve Martin played it on the beach, but it didn't. But ukuleles are becoming far more common nowadays, and I feel like most guitar players are buying them because they're looking at them and they're like, I can figure this out. I know how to do this. It's, you know, in their brain, they're making that bridge, that association.
Yeah,
with the
exactly
way the strings
right.
are laid out in the notes on it.
And it's a great way to move from your regular acoustic guitar on a campfire tone to something that's completely different. It's a lot softer and mellower.
Yeah.
And you get, because of the higher string on what would normally be the bass end, you get a completely different voicing of every chord. So you can play your regular C or D shape and suddenly it sounds completely different.
Yeah. Right?
So it adds a new level of timbre to what would normally be just your regular cowboy chords. It's a fun way to change up music that would normally just be the same thing. But it's just like banjo. Man, I've been playing banjo a lot lately, and coming at it from a guitarist's perspective is probably the worst thing you could do.
Really?
Because it's, the tuning is, it's an open G, but highest string is closer to you, like your thumb. Normally, if you're playing an alternating bass with your right hand,
yeah,
you'd be, the lowest string is usually the one that's closest to your body, but the highest string on the banjo is the one that's close to your body. It sort of turns the whole thing upside down. But at the same time, that is a Rubik's Cube. That's a challenge, and that's something that that's so exciting to me right now. It's like learning how to play this instrument that's completely back-asswards.
And yet I feel like banjos have been far more associated with folk music than the guitar, to be honest with you. Like, more people associate
certainly
that pitch, that tone of the string, that sort of metallic quality to it, more so than, you know, the sound of the cowboy chords.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel like Pete Seeger had a lot to do with that too, in the sense that he was one of the forerunners. I guess he's like America's conscience, you know, the voice of the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
And he always slung that banjo around with him, and so there's a lot of associations made because of him. And, well, not to mention the Appalachian music too, like all that old time stuff. The banjo and fiddle combination is pretty much timeless.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful sound. I'm glad to see that there's a resurgence coming. I've noticed there's a lot of my peers in like the folk, or rather the folk scene now, were people that were doing punk rock music.
Yeah.
You know, when we were all growing up. It seems like everyone's sort of almost, I hesitate to say matured, because I still listen almost exclusively to metal music when I put my headphones on.
Yeah.
But it's a lot more approachable, but it still deals with the same themes that punk music is dealing with, you know, like social equality and injustices that are occurring in our political system. But it addresses them in a way that's accessible to, in that transcendent way, like we were talking about earlier, that spans generations.
For sure. And it's like, just as much as these songs are timeless, you know, there's always been trouble every day. There's always something wrong. There's always something going on. There's always been injustice. There's always been some imbalance and some need for a counterculture. I mean, it's funny when you have a workshop of, you know, musicians talking about, like Woody Guthrie, for example, and you have like Billy Bragg up there, and then you have like a newer, you know, sort of musician that's just come out in the last decade, you know, and they're all talking about the same thing, but, you know, the message hasn't changed. It's just the medium has it's just in a younger vessel, it seems.
Yeah, exactly. Things just channeled in a distorted way, you know, there's almost, the timbre of the music reflects the aggression and displeasure, you know, that the younger generation that I was feeling when I was playing punk rock music, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing that you could put into an acoustic guitar that would make it sound as pissed off as I was then.
Yeah.
You know? And so when you plug it in, distort it, turn it right up, and then bash the drums as loud and as fast as you can, that's the only way to really channel that aggression. But to quote John Brooks, who's a singer, songwriter, and poet from Ontario, whom we've been seeing over the last couple of years on the circuit, he says, as long as there are politicians, folk singers will have a job. There's someone that needs to stand up to what sort of garbage we're being fed.
Yeah.
and speak up about it.
And it's a very, I just get this visual of like the people who control the electricity are, they can shut down your amps, but if you're playing folk music, you can't shut it off. Those strings will always make that sound. They'll always be loud enough. You know, you have to pry that instrument from my cold dead hands.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. So what got you, you said you're happy to see other musicians going from punk and sort of louder music to folk music. And I mean, there's tons of great examples in the past few years. One of my favorites, of which was, Daniel Romano from, Attack in Black. Now he's playing, you know, as a full-fledged, like, folk singer. He's got
straight up,
Western Works shirt and the cowboy hat on.
Exactly right. Or, Cor Blund.
Yeah.
Who's also made the transition, I guess, less sort of folk and more sort of country.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the same sort of deal.
Or the band The Men started out as a very aggressive band, and now they're playing on more of they sound more like The Birds than they did like they used to. It's an interesting transition to see people make. And I wonder about it because a lot of we all have that moment where there's that kid where they're like, you know, they start wearing band shirts and maybe they put on makeup and they're like, oh, I've always been punk. And you wonder like, yeah. You know, have you? So I wonder what the feeling is like when you have a friend who used to play loud and aggressive music and, or used to, you know, wear those band t-shirts all the time. And all of a sudden it's Western Work shirts and banjos and things like that. Like, you know, you kind of have to hope it's not another phase, right? I wonder, like, what was the process like for you transitioning between those two genres?
Well, the process was largely as we described, really. Like, I started listening to bluegrass music, and that's what really caught my ear. Because I've been saying for a while now that bluegrass is really like the metal of acoustic music.
It is.
Super fast, super shreddy, the virtuosic nature of it is what really drew my ear to it in the first place. But it also has its same sort of classical composition in the sense that there is the exposition and then the repetition. It's like A parts and B parts, essentially. It's like part A, part B, and then a conclusion everyone is agreed upon. At the end, there's like the signal. Everyone knows when the end is coming.
Yeah.
And the same sort of deal happened in Baroque and Romantic music. So in that sense, it was largely bluegrass that caught my ear because I just wanted to play that kind of fast music without having to carry an amp around anymore. So I guess folk music was the next logical step. I gotta say, I have to attribute a lot of that to my father as well, who's really raised me on James Taylor and Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell, and just made sure that that was a part of the litany of songs that we listened to growing up. And some of it was recordings and some of it was the stuff that he was playing, you know, like putting us to sleep.
Yeah.
And he'd sit at the piano while my brothers and I all stayed in the room and just like played five or six songs before going to bed. And I guess it was a bit of a return to that, partially nostalgia, partially in the sense that I sort of wish to contribute to that in the same way. And trying to find that feeling again, that feeling of oneness. You know that feeling. Everyone gets that feeling when they hear that tune. You know, it doesn't matter what genre it is, but that's what it was for me, at least. And a lot of it came from the experience of hanging out around campfires, like socializing with peers, drinking a few beers around a campfire anywhere, you know, where there's no more electricity, there's no more, you know, bright lights. It's just your personalities that really come to light. And that's the way stories and legends have been shared since time immemorial. You know, and songs have always been a part of that as well. But folk music gives a template and a format through which that we can easily communicate these ideas and feelings to each other. And I guess I just, I found inspiration and beauty in that. And I've sort of did my best to contribute and share in that as well.
Wow. Speaking of the campfire visual, which is scattered all throughout your interviews and your press releases and everything associated with the band, the campfire is a really strong image there. But you actually also have a project called Fire and Smoke. I wonder, was that sort of formed in the campfire environment or?
Yeah, quite largely. Although now, unfortunately, defunct Claire is living in Montreal now and pursuing a solo career. We met around a campfire at the Winnipeg Folk Festival. We were just kind of a bunch of us were trying to one-up each other with songs and slow groove started going on, and then she sort of came out of nowhere in the darkness. And, you know, you can only partially see people around a campfire, and her just smoky voice came, just pierced right through everything. And she was singing Ain't No Sunshine by Bill Withers, and everyone just like stopped and turned and looked and was like, who is that? So we jammed a few tunes and then found each other afterwards and ended up starting a project there too. But to answer the question directly, yes, campfires really are, like, to me, the genesis of all good and honest and real music. So I find in that forum, you can really know if a song is going to be worth its weight.
Yeah.
Because regardless of what sort of bells and whistles you attach to it, if you can play a song around a campfire or even just sing it a cappella and communicate that same, the same semantics and that same feeling in that setting, then no matter what you do to it, it's still going to be a brilliant song.
Yeah. I actually am just thinking about how many people in like the folk festival campground are, you know, they meet somebody at night or on the campfire and they play a couple songs together and maybe they're a little too drunk and they kind of look at each other and like, we're starting a band the moment we get back to the city.
Yeah,
and they
exactly.
never call again. It's no, like a
man.
Musical one night stand.
The city eats you up. Yeah, exactly. It's okay. It's great.
Yeah.
A big part of it's like falling in love for one night around the campfire, you know?
Fair
same,
enough.
Same sort of bag.
Fair enough. All right.
Sometimes with the follow up is immediate and, you know, real, and the timing works out, then bands happen.
Yeah. Now your current project, Red Moon Road, the quote from the bio is that you were born of a storm, and I've read the story in CBC that you guys were like in a cabin, like, you know, trying to hide away from a storm, and there was a piano in the cabin. Like, how romantic is that?
Yeah, it's pretty legit.
Kind of the opposite, really, of the campfire, right? It's more so like, well, I mean, you're still looking for warmth, you know, to stay out of the cold, but it's you know, fire and water, opposite sort of imagery, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's important to maintain a balance between all the elements as well. I mean,
indeed. I'm waiting for your lightning band.
Yeah. Well, the lightning band was where the metal was.
Oh yeah, that's
all electricity, yeah. Baby. yeah, no, that is. Exactly how it happened. We were on a sailboat, the other Daniel and I, before this band came to be, but we ended up getting knocked over in a storm. The sailboat tipped, our two of the buddies were there with us, and it ended up being a boat. Like, none of us drowned, fortunately, but we ended up in the back of the boat being dragged behind, because if all of us had gotten into it, the boat would have just sank. So there's one, we're bailing from the back, Daniel was sailing it, we made it to the nearest piece of land, which was another island nearby, and there was no one there. It was October, end of October. It was a ridiculous time to be out sailing anyway, but we both came off the road and we both needed an adventure, you know, to get back out to the land. And so there we were, soaking, quasi-hypothermic. And, so we broke into this cabin. Sorry to the owner of this cabin. I'm very sorry about that, but your cabin formed a sweet band. So thanks for that. Yeah. Tana was fully in tune and, yeah, so to stave off hypothermia, we were kind of jumping around this fire and put all our clothes on the stove and sang songs. Figured if we can survive this sort of ridiculous environment, we can probably survive being on the road together. So,
yeah.
And the rest is history.
And how does touring with, with people who are not, people who are, how's touring with family been versus touring with friends?
Different, for sure.
Yeah.
Because my metal band was both of my brothers and I, and our childhood friend as well. And, I mean, that was just an extension of our home life, really. There was no difference there at all. But after a while, like after touring with Daniel and Sheena and Red Moon Road for these past 3 years, you sort of become family in a way that you can't with your blood relatives, you know? It's like sort of a shared understanding that you're in this together no matter what, but at the same time you come from disparate backgrounds. You don't share that the far-reaching history and the blood. It's everyone coming from a different perspective, coming together for this purpose, and it's been great getting to know these people in a way that that's far too intimate, and at the same time it's a really beautiful relationship blossoms where you find your strengths and you patch in where other people's weaknesses are, and you find where people's buttons are. You make sure you don't push them.
Yeah.
When you're living in close proximity, it's just like sharing, like living with roommates, basically, except your house is a car.
Has the vehicle at least been upgrading over the years as you've been traveling, or is it still the same old reliable four wheels under you?
Old reliable that I pulled up in that little Volvo station wagon. It's just turned over to 400,000 kilometers when we were in Quebec this summer.
Congratulations. So, congratulations.
Still making it.
Yeah. So you did the folk festival circuit in the summer. I mean, you got to see some smaller ones. You got to see some bigger ones. Do you have a particular folk festival that, like, the moment you left, you kind of just wanted to turn back around and you know, stick around for the rest of the...
Man, every one of them really had that same sort of vibe.
Yeah.
Something about that deliberate, shared, communal living that people engage in for a weekend is a profound experience like no other. As anyone who's been to a festival... of any kind understands, you never really want to leave because those people become your family.
Yeah.
For that short period of time, and everything that's just so well organized, they've thought of every eventuality and planned for it. I don't think I could point out just one that stood out more than the others because, I mean, Lunenburg Harbor, Folk Harbor Festival happened just south of Halifax where the Blue Nose is docked. So we played Facing the Blue Nose. Like, are you kidding me? In this historic town with just steeped in history and tradition and all the beauty that you imagine the East Coast has.
Yeah.
Living there for that experience was transcendent. It was absolutely unreal. And then we played in Guelph for the Hillside Festival.
Which is an amazing experience, yeah.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Both in terms of the programming, the bands they had were unreal from, like, straight up... future pop, like Royal Canoe was playing there.
Yeah.
Which is great because Daniel and my band is brothers with Michael and their band. So it was cool that our bands would actually ever play the same festival together. But Hoxie Workman's new project was there.
Oh, Feist has the Mounties?
Mounties, yeah. And Feist's side project, Hydra,
okay,
was there too. It's like it's sort of a weird testing ground for all these interesting new projects.
Yeah, it's a stone's throw from Toronto, and they can just they can relax for a weekend.
Yeah, exactly. It's a hop, skip, and a jump from everywhere in the GTA, it seems. And not only that, but the location is unreal too. It's on an island, just north of Guelph. You're close enough to the city that all the amenities are there, but the hardcore is all camp anyway.
Yeah,
it's pretty incredible. In terms of the actual full festival experience, that might have been one of the more impressive ones, just because it's on a scale that we haven't really seen from the inside as performers yet. So that might be the one that I'd love to go back to, just in the sense that it was huge.
It's like you said, it's a proving ground. It's a lot of people bring their new projects there. And I remember, like, they had Arcade Fire in the past. They've had some amazingly huge bands just go in and perform. That's one of those lineups that I get a little envy about whenever I see it. Like, I love the folk festival here and for certain reasons, and I love that one for other ones. And
yeah.
Yeah. Did you get a chance to bump into Bruce Coburn at all in Sudbury during Northern Lights?
The most that I really got a chance to see of him was when he was doing his sound check. They actually had us working pretty hard there too. Like, we
workshops.
Yeah, we're workshopping and traveling from stage to stage.
Yeah, so I got electronic carts.
Yeah, exactly. Getting shuffled around, and getting. Oh man, it's such a bizarre and really cool experience to just be like shuffled around from place to place. Suddenly, you're not the one doing the hustling. You're the one that's like, okay, gotta be on. What do I have to be? And people are there to like move your stuff for you, so you just show up and put on the best performance that you can. And that's your job. You are that cog in the machine. You know, it's a pretty cool place to be. Bruce, man, can that guy hold the attention of thousands of people.
Really?
Oh, he's unreal. He played after the Melbourne Ska Orchestra, which is like a 27-piece ska band from
that sounds
Australia.
Like Paul Loewenberg, something he'd book.
Totally. So I went from this gigantic production right down to one man and his guitar, center stage under a spotlight, you know. And I only caught him at his sound check, so I got to see that sort of aspect of this humble yet brilliant man. I wish I could have actually had a chance to talk shop. It's too bad. It's one of those experiences where, it's one of those places where you actually have that sort of approachability, you know, as an artist, and even as a monster such as him is still just a guy backstage with his own green room kind of deal, you know.
Exactly.
If I had the time, I definitely would have gone up and, you know, shook his hand. But I'm sure he gets it all the time.
It's tough to say when you've written that many great songs, or you've been played on the radio that much, you're gonna have people come up to you.
That's gonna happen. Yeah, exactly.
But you know what's remarkably kind of like the most accessible version of that is Fred Penner, like someone who's like influenced people since childhood, and he gets you hooked on folk music at a young age as well, because he does those folk festival circuits. I remember Fred Penner did Northern Lights one year, and he made me sing with him on stage because I was hosting the stage, and he was doing an encore, and he grabbed me. He's like, "Nope, you're singing with me." He wouldn't let me say no. And and he's huge.
No kidding. Not only in personality, but in stature too.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a commanding presence.
But it's amazing how humble someone like that can be. But I guess he kind of has to be, because in the end, it's not about the adults that he's influenced. It's about like everyone that he's influenced. And, you know, there's no time to leave a bad impression. And there's, you know, he kind of seems like he's always on, but he's always so, I don't know. He's
genuine.
He's very reserved and genuine. Yeah.
Yeah. He is exactly who he portrays that he is. You know, there's nothing superficial about him. It's like him and Valdi, I think, share that in common. Two greats that have influenced two generations now of Canadians in that sense are still just people, like approachable people, and are happy to give you the time of day. They don't have any sort of star complexes. It's not like they need to run from paparazzi. Yeah. I guess this, which is another bonus of playing folk music, that you don't end up in the public eye. You're not deified in the same sense that a lot of pop stars are, where they almost lose their humanity.
Yeah.
In that sense, folk music really amplifies the humanity of the singer as opposed to dehumanizing them and making them into a commodity. So in that sense, really happy to be in this genre for that reason.
Yeah.
And being a part of that sort of family, I guess, of players.
I think that's the importance of the workshop, actually, at the folk festival. Like, it kind of just dawned on me, like, that's kind of one of the things that keeps people so tied and grounded to reality is the workshop stage, you know?
Oh, yeah.
An opportunity to play with your peers, and an opportunity to influence your peers as well, but also an opportunity to go and be closer to the ground level, to just sit down and relax and only have to play like two songs, and but also address the audience in a very informal way. Like, it's...
Yeah, it strips you out of your show.
Exactly.
You can so easily... especially after having toured for 63 days this summer, you sort of start to get into a bit of a zone, I guess. You know, when you play the same, we toured with a repertoire of probably 20 songs, and we drew probably 9 from that repertoire for each show. So everything was getting to the point where it was all nearly automatic.
Yeah.
You know, and we had everything that we're going to say in between was mostly off the cuff, but we had themes that we'd stick to. We try to keep it as professional and, you know, clipped and clean as possible. But coming down to the workshop stage, it sort of strips that from you, you know? You are just who you are with your abilities and your song. And you're not, I don't want to say at the mercy, more like you're bettered by the people that you share the stage with, because you're literally sharing the stage with them.
Yeah.
You don't, you have your few moments to introduce your song. And if I think any folk musician worth their weight is going to be inviting others to play along, unless it's a particularly complex tune that might not be jammable. But there's an etiquette there, I feel, that has developed over the course of the years since the workshop has been introduced. And that's, I don't know, to me it's like a campfire.
Exactly.
Just to tie it back in, like, it's really that.
They put their campfire on stage, and then they just can't light the fire because of whatever reason. But now there's campfire stages at a lot of folk festivals that have camping. Like, there are Northern Lights Festival Boreal, which is another one that's based out of just outside of Sudbury. Mm-hmm. They have a campfire stage, so they have a little campfire set up, and then a tiny little performance area, and people will do, like, acoustic shows out there. So
it's brilliant. It's a format that's... You know, it's been going since the dawn of time.
Exactly.
So now they're just bringing it to, it's like they're taking a chunk out of what would be such a huge machine and reducing it down to what its brilliant initial roots were. You know? Yeah.
Just a couple more things I want to touch on. One of them is the workshop stage. First of all, is there anyone you've done a workshop with? I usually ask people to pay it forward in the show to another performer and say, like, is there anyone you recommend people want to listen to? But the workshop stage, I'm really curious about this because, yeah, it's a special kind of experience to see, like, all those sort of just anyone from a local person to a traveling music. Like, I got to do a workshop once with Jeff Berner, for example. And yeah, and so, you know, I tell a story and then he's kind of standing on the other side of the stage, just like, all right, well, this song's in G, and then just like goes on this political tirade on an accordion. And right. Like, I didn't want to touch it. I didn't want anything to do with it.
Yeah.
But, you get to share the stage with some really interesting people. Is there anyone you've done a workshop with that you were just completely blown away by?
Right away, there are a couple bands that come to mind. There was one of those transcendent musical experiences that I really live for that occurred at the Lunenburg Festival with a band called the Steel Wheels,
okay,
based out of Virginia. And they're a four-piece. They're clearly steeped in the traditions of, like, of just purist bluegrass. And they rock it with, like, the single mic. It's all very, very purist, but their songwriting is a little bit more modern. They put an interesting twist and write new songs as though they were old-time tunes. We did a workshop with them, and, oh boy, what was her name again? Daisy Mayhem. What was her name? Shoot, it'll come to me. Yeah, it's not coming. But we did a workshop with them in a church, in an old Anglican church.
Oh, wow.
That was just gorgeous in visually and acoustically. And we did the gospel workshop with them in the morning, which was just absolutely outstanding, playing old spiritual songs, song after song, with all these stellar musicians, and more importantly, vocalists also. We really took advantage of the acoustics in that area, and everyone was really sensitive to each other's parts and harmonies and found where there was a bit of a space in the sonic spectrum and filled it just beautifully. So it just made for such a patchwork quilt of audio delight. It was just sensational. So the Steel Wheels are a really standout band. We made fast friends with them right away, and who else we meet there? Gypsophilia.
Okay.
Another band out of Halifax. Gypsy music. They're just absolutely real. Okay. Yeah. So much fun.
And the last thing I want to talk about is I had the pleasure a few years ago of interviewing Stuart McLean, and there's an interview.
Interviewer becomes interviewee.
Oh, he's so different too when you talk to him in person.
I bet.
But you know, one thing that I think is really interesting about him is and one thing he mentioned in the interview that I thought was great was he really paid it forward to a lot of musicians. Like he talked a lot about bands that people need to focus and pay attention to.
Right.
So, in an interview that, or in an article about your band, Red Moon Road, there's a quote near the end that just kind of out of context didn't seem to fit in, because it was an interview with your bandmates. And then there's one sort of quick flash of a comment you made about wanting to do a performance on the Vinyl Cafe.
Yeah.
And then the article just kind of resumed, and it just seemed a little out of place, but I think that's interesting. Is it the storytelling, or is it just that it's an interesting kind of show to be a part of, or have you just always been a Stuart McLean fan that you want to do the show so badly?
Columns A through Z.
Excellent.
I'd say, you know, it's the combination of everything. It's the storytelling and the way that he weaves the story in with the interactions with the audience.
Yeah.
It ties it in through music. It's just woven together so seamlessly and so beautifully, and it's a medium. Radio to me is still my favorite medium.
Oh yeah.
Your imagination still has room. You know, it's not like all your senses are being assaulted with flashy visuals, as well as, like, you know, 0.5 second cuts, like all these ADD kind of, you know, flashing lights and talking heads. Stuart McLean and everything that the CBC does really is, to my ears, the voice of what it means to be Canadian.
For sure.
And that's the fabric of our nation in my books. Like, this guy travels, you know, from city to city telling stories from all these small towns all across the great nation. And, I mean, I've got my own reservations about what nationalism means in the global environment, but I could easily say that it's the CBC that ties us all together, and Stuart McLean is definitely one of the spokespeople in that sense. So to answer your question, playing that show to me would be like, I guess, putting my name on the Canadian flag, you know, like doing my part, putting my stitch in to try and hold it all together.
Nice. Nice. That's a very smart answer. All right. Well, thanks for doing the show. This has been great. And, if people want to find your music or whatever you guys are working on nowadays online, is there a place they can go?
Yeah. I mean, you can easily find us on every social media platform. I tweet, Daniel does Facebook, Shane does Instagram.
Okay.
And, between the three of us, we keep our website updated as well with all of our upcoming tour dates. We're going to be gone for the month of October, but we'll be releasing our newest record November 15th at the West End Cultural Center.
Amazing. Amazing.
So yeah, looking forward to that. Track us down online, redmondroad.com.
Okay. Excellent.
Matt, well, thanks
so much,
man,
for doing the show.
It's pleasure's mine.
Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode, and thank you so much to Danielle from Red Moon Road for that interview. It was an absolute treat, as he called it, a meeting of minds, and I have to err to that side. I have to agree with him on this one. So thanks so much, guys, for that. And if you want to check out his band, you can follow them on Twitter at Red Moon Road, as well as on Instagram at Red Moon Road. If you want to find them on Facebook and give them a like there, give them validation in any form. In fact, go to www.redmoonroad.com, stream the album, Fall in Love, then go to the Bandcamp page, toss them a couple of dollars for a digital copy of the record, or go and see them at the West End Cultural Center this November and purchase the new record. Either way, every little bit counts. Every monetary contribution to this idea is beneficial to the, you know, the growth and the expansion of this operation, because these people are doing a good thing. They are doing a good thing to folk music. They are taking folk music out on a Saturday night, and they are offering its jacket when it gets too cold in the movie theater, and they are putting their arm around it, and they're driving it home at a respectful hour and nodding to you from the car saying, "Don't worry, folk is safe with me. We care." Speaking of musicians as well, if you want to check out the musician behind our introductory and interstitial music, look up Tyson Brinacombe. He has a new album out on Label Fantastic, called Casio Fiasco. It's getting great reviews, so I highly recommend checking it out. Also, the music playing in the background right now is the band NASA, based out of Winnipeg, Manitoba. Their newest record, Losing Weight, will be available by next month. And if you want to hear my lovely singing voice, come on down to Ma's Eatery. I'm doing a free show. It's Matt Mosco's Whiskey-Fueled Fairy Tales on October 8th, 2014 at 9 p.m. It's myself playing three sets of music with tons of guest features from some of my local favorites. It's just going to be one of those nights where you can just kind of absorb the atmosphere of a bar. I don't need your constant validation up there. I just want your warmth. Remember that you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. You can leave us a review. You can drop us some stars. You know what stars do for Super Mario. Imagine what 5 stars would do to me. Just saying. So drop us a couple of stars or leave a review on iTunes, Stitcher Radio. Subscribe to the channel. Tune in every week. I'll keep making them if you keep listening. I'll probably keep making them if you stop listening, but that'll be a little different. People will be wondering where the microphones are. You want something to look forward to? Next week I am interviewing Steven Sim and possibly Lee White of famous improv duo Crumbs. They'll be talking about the Winnipeg Improv Festival. And the week after that, Breakout West is coming, so I have snagged myself an interview with none other than Fred Penner, children's folk musician and adult folk musician Fred Penner. And I'll be telling a story about he and I during that show as well. He came and blessed me years ago. So thank you so much for tuning in. My name is Matt Moskal, and remember, support your local everything, and everybody's got to open for somebody sometime. Cheers.